Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. It's one of the thorniest management problems around, dealing with unmotivated, low-performing employees. It's easy to point the finger of blame at them, but in most companies, it's the reward system, not the workforce, that's causing poor attitudes and performance. Many reward systems actually discourage desired behaviors while rewarding the very actions that drive executives crazy. In his new book, Reward Systems, Does Yours Deliver?, author Steve Kerr describes the steps you must take to create an effective reward system. Steve Kerr is the former chief learning officer of Goldman Sachs and General Electric. Steve, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks very much.
In your new book, you describe an effective three-step process to help organizations realign their reward systems. Can you give us an overview of that process?
I'm happy to, and I'd start by saying that most people are fascinated by reward systems. We're all reading about CEO executive pay and options and overrides, very few of which we have. The consultants combined say, let us bring your reward system into the 21st century. The book makes the point, though, that reward should be the third thing you work on. And if you start too soon, you cause more mischief than help. Mm-hmm. Rewards depend on measurement. In short, you can't reward the high performers with money and trips and all the things that constitute rewards if you don't know who they are. And so the second step becomes measurement. And when people think they can't reward something, I can't reward creativity or I can't reward integrity, they invariably mean they have trouble measuring it. So rewards depend on measurement. Measurement depends on definition and making it operational.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
We have to build measures that reflect what we honestly want people to do. This sounds easy, but in fact, performance is often defined in very glowing terms. Customer service, we're going to be the best, et cetera. And it leads to a wide interpretation of what is really desired. Therefore, metrics end up being very different. Therefore, rewards are, and we end up encouraging inadvertently the wrong behaviors.
Okay, let's break this down and take it step by step. How do you define performance in actionable terms?
There's a wonderful technique that's been around forever called the bullseye exercise because it has that shape. And the way it works is simple. You put in the top circle of the three the thing you're trying to make actionable. Mm-hmm. So it could be we want creativity, or we want more risk-taking, or we want more customer focus, or we want more integrity or humility, or whatever it is. The device is as old as the hills. It's called backward imaging. Covey calls it starting with the end in mind, where you say you're at a party a year from today and you're celebrating the success of this thing. Compared to a year ago, your people are now more creative or taking more risks or being more candid and so on. And then the question becomes, what are people doing differently? The key word is doing. How are they acting? How are they behaving now in ways that they weren't a year ago? Specifically, what are they doing more of? What are they doing less of? You'll find people generally agree very much on the top circle. Who doesn't want more creativity and more risk-taking and more honesty and more integrity? But when you hit the bullseye and you describe actions, you find often there are differences. People don't automatically agree on what the specific behaviors are that constitute these things. So it leads to a great discussion. And once you get consensus, or once somebody makes the decision, the other steps I mentioned become quite straightforward. That is, if I know what actions you want, I can always measure actions. I can always measure behaviors. You can watch them. You can tape them. You can see how other people see you. So 360s and other devices kick in. And then having been able to measure them, of course, you can do the rewards.
Right.
So the first step, making these things actionable using some kind of a bullseye technique. It also involves a great process that permits delegation so that everybody in the organization is working on the same thing, but using their own special expertise.
How does an organization know if it's measuring the right things?
Some things are pretty straightforward. If you're in a selling organization, you want to know if people are doing sales. In manufacturing, you'll measure scrap and cost and cycle time and inventory turns. The trouble is, sometimes the most important ones are not quite so objective or quite so obvious.
Okay.
My book talks about a technique called a clean sheet. In brief, it's this. We say, imagine if you had no metrics, starting from scratch. The phone rings, your admin comes in holding the phone and says in a nervous voice, you better take this. The question is, who might be on the other end of the phone that would provoke that kind of reaction where you have to take the call? This permits you to identify the major stakeholders. It could be a customer. It could be a supplier. It could be a regulator. It could be an employee. If you have unions, it could be a union and so on. Then you take them one at a time and you say, what are the dimensions in which we need metrics? That is, what are the dimensions in which we're vulnerable?
For instance?
Take customers, for example. We say, what might the customer be on the phone complaining about or telling you? price is too high, the stuff didn't arrive, you sent the wrong stuff, the quality is poor. So in no time, you'll learn what the key dimensions are of the different stakeholders.
Mm-hmm.
Then once you have those, you make a list of your present measurements. What do we keep track of now? And then using a trusty magic marker, just draw some lines. It's not very quantitative. And you'll see two things. One, there'll be things where that phone will have to ring before you're actually aware that you have that problem. That is, you have no metric that gives you early warning, ideally to prevent it, or at least let you know before you get the phone call.
Right.
In addition, you'll find there are things you're probably building metrics for now where the phone would never ring. That may be a defect. That is, it may be a legacy, something that used to be worth measuring that isn't now, or it may be something you just want to do well as an internal. As a quick example, I did this exercise with some people from Johnson & Johnson. They had a number of metrics where they track customer service and things, giving to charity and community involvement. And they said, look, the phone would never ring, but it's not a defect. We don't do it for the phone to ring. We do it because this is stuff we believe in as part of our culture. So that's an exercise that will hopefully not give you brand new ideas. It should validate the metrics already in place, but often you find a few things that kind of got lost in the shuffle.
Now, reward means different things to different people. How do you determine the right reward to offer someone?
Well, you start with the definition in the dictionary. Reward is something that increases the probability that people will do what you reward them for. The trouble is sometimes you give things that you're sure will be attractive rewards, but in fact, people don't care about them, or worse, may even dislike them. The book describes a number of such examples. One fast one is there was an organization that gave Friday night pizza parties to the high-performing employees during that week. Went on for quite a while till somebody thought to ask the employees how they felt about it. And they said, you know, no offense, we work with these people all week. We work long nights during the week. It's Friday. We'd just soon be home with our family. We wish you wouldn't do this.
Hmm.
Another quick example, to save money, a Detroit company cut out support for the after-hour clubs and work organizations, among which was the Canadian Division's hockey team, which they stopped supporting in the middle of the season. They found out that this was a tremendously important reward that they hadn't thought about and therefore had inadvertently cut off while it didn't cost them much money to retain. So there's no substitute for asking your people. Many organizations have people surveys. The main point is not that you have to be profound in your questions, but don't fail to ask. Don't just make the assumption, I know what other people want. People have very different needs and wants, and there's no harm in finding out what they say.
Exactly. How do companies find ways to keep high performers motivated and engaged when there may be no money to go around?
There are many rewards that are quite powerful. Money is a fine reward. I wouldn't dissuade you from using it, but the basic test of a reward system is it available? And if you don't have it, stop trying to build a whole system upon it. So keeping high performers engaged, obviously you'd like to give them more money than low performers.
Of course.
You can still do this, by the way, even if the total pool is low. In tough times, organizations often make a mistake. At the very moment they should be carefully husbanding their meager cash to give to the high performers, they do the opposite. They go to freezes and cross-the-board cuts, and all these things hurt the high performers more than any. So for starters, don't be doing that. You have to continue to differentiate so the high performers feel valued. Money is not only used to spend, it's used as a sign, a signal that they're valued, it's feedback, and this is important.
Absolutely.
But especially attention should be paid to the non-financial rewards. The problem is if they say reward and recognition systems, it's a bad term. You shouldn't permit it because it implies that rewards are money and recognition is that cute other stuff you do.
Mm-hmm.
But the non-financial rewards, that's the right term, not recognition. It includes recognition. It includes making people feel responsible, giving them more chances to participate. Performance feedback is a great reward. We often ask people, in most organizations, who gets more money, high performers or low? With exceptions, most people say high.
Right.
Then you say, in most organizations, who gets more feedback, high performers or low? And the common response is low performers. If you look in the dictionary, feedback is as good a reward, or at least potentially so, as money. Yet, we don't think of the non-financials as rewards. Therefore, we don't use them in a systematic way. If hard times continue, eventually, of course, people need money, and they're not going to stay forever. But it's instructive to note that nuns and soldiers and nurses and teachers and rehabilitation therapists do stay forever. That is, they have jobs that they take knowing they won't provide much money, but the non-financial rewards, responsibility and meaning and recognition and so on are high, and you often get levels of motivation you would love to have in your own organization.
You said metrics is a precursor to rewards. What are the problems with the metric systems?
Perhaps the most important problem is the widespread belief that measurement should be objective. Now, in the first place, there's no such thing as an objective measure. And if you think you have one, tell me what it is and give me a few minutes to think about it, and I'll show you how to look good on that measure while doing harm to your organization. Inherently, measures have to be subjective. It doesn't mean you don't rely on data, but it comes down to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Sales, for example, is often held up to be about as objective a measure of performance as there is. Yet if you ask people which is the more important determinant of sales success, the skill of the salesperson or the fertility of the territory, almost everyone will agree that an average salesman who sells in Scarsdale or Shaker Heights or Beverly Hills or New Rochelle is going to have better sales than your best salesman sitting in a lower middle class neighborhood.
Hmm.
So one thing is to judge how difficult the sales were or the measure was.
Very interesting.
Another problem is that we tend to resort to competitive measures, for example, using ranking instead of rating. Now, there are 1,000 names for performance measurement systems, but there are really only two. A rating system compares people to an absolute standard. When you first went to kindergarten, you had one of those. It was works and plays well with others. And if you did a good job, Sally didn't have to do a bad job. They were comparing against the standard.
Right.
Ranking systems compare people to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the result is you're told you didn't get a reward or a promotion or a pay raise because Henry was better than you were.
Oh, yeah.
The idea of using relative rankings and pitting people against people, one, gives you no specific things to get better at. Two, makes you resentful of Henry. There's a major university that tends to hire 4 assistant professors, for example, and says at the end of 7 years, one of you may be granted tenure. Good luck. If you look at that university, the assistant professors do not write articles together, nor do they pursue grants together. And the reason is, you're now my competitor, you're my rival, and if we co-author a publication, I've gained no relative advantage. When you tell students you're grading on a curve, they don't form study teams.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the good reward system is one that gives you what you want.
Okay.
So if you want people to be competitive, if you believe that that gets the juices going and they'll be higher performers, more power to you. On the other hand, most organizations say they want teamwork, camaraderie, they want people to be collaborative.
Exactly.
But these rank and yank or quartiling or performance ranking systems, which pit people against other people, discourage the very collaboration you're set to be wanting. That's another major problem with metrics, that you sometimes impair the very qualities you're trying to foster with the metric. Remember, the metric is a powerful signal. Of course, you'd rather have a good one than a bad one, but the good news is a sloppy, imperfect measure gives you most of the same power as a good one because it tells people this is important, we're going to track it.
Now, given the current state of the economy with layoffs and salary freezes, what are some of the low-hanging fruits that organizations can offer to the staff?
It's well known that one of the most important non-financial rewards is the opportunity to participate. The same decision which people will hate if it comes from the boss's office, people will fight for if they believe that they've helped think of it.
Right.
Think of the U.S. president in your lifetime. You have the most respect for. And then you think of the president for whom you have the least respect. We don't have a tendency to put in uniformly good leaders.
Hmm.
America is not unique in the quality of its leaders. What is unique is that unlike any other major nation state, we've had no revolution, no violent overthrow in the more than 200 years of our existence. If you were to look at any other major nation state, China, Russia, France, England, Germany, Japan, they've all had violent overthrows one time or another, not because their leaders were worse than ours necessarily, but because of participation, the opportunity to vote, to be involved. Even if you lose, you say, I've had my say, and you're much more likely to stay with it.
Interesting.
My point is, in tough times, leaders are often afraid to go to participation because they fear they're going to get grousing and cynicism and anger and the rest of it. Of course, all of those are possible. None of us likes being in these times.
Of course not.
But in GE, for example, after people were laid off, there were no promises that layoffs wouldn't continue. In short, the very time you would think you would not use participation or employee involvement, we put in a participative technique called workout. I was myself cynical and thought it was dangerous to use it, but it was amazing how powerful this was. So for low-hanging fruit during these tough times, getting people involved, what would you do? Even sharing the problems, you say, I've got less money. What would you do if you were me? I want your advice. I'm not guaranteeing I'll follow it, but I'm really interested in your views. There's no harm. People may even refuse the offer to participate. You get paid, you make the decision, but the offer to be included is never harmful.
Absolutely.
I'll start with one last example. I'm not recommending it's so severe, I was sure it was a bad idea, but it wasn't. They announced that a plant was going to be closed, and there was nothing the employees could do to prevent it. They told them up front, but they said, we would welcome your ideas about how to make this as painless as possible, how to make it fair. And I thought, this is just nuts. And what the people did was a little bit of venting, and then they came up with some great outplacement help, and they came up with ways to make it fair that people would stay longer or shorter to close up the plant. It was just amazing what people can do.
Yeah.
Feedback is another piece of low-hanging fruit because we're doing it anyway. But we do it in ways that tend to turn off people. We find that most negative information, people tend to value their own contribution higher than the boss does. That's just statistics. The reason is we judge ourselves by our intentions. We tend to judge other people by their actions. If we miss a deadline, we have unique knowledge of the promised staff support that didn't materialize, to keep people out sick or on vacation, the garbled orders from the boss. He's lucky we figured out what to do at all. And meanwhile, you're thinking, Kerr missed another deadline. So there's a lot that can be done. This is easily bought training. There are manuals. There are guides. You can do it fun through role plays, teaching people how to present information, particularly negative feedback, in ways that make it accepted. As I mentioned earlier, feedback is often not thought of as a reward, but it really is. And it does increase the probability that people will do what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Those are examples of things you can do. Not instead of money. No one's going to take that for years. But recessions have always ended, and this one will too. And these are things one can do to keep people engaged and retained until the money returns.
The name of the book is Reward Systems, and the author is Steve Kerr. Thanks for joining us today, Steve.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
As always, we'd love to get your feedback. So please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.